The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, The Watchers. Who are they? For most of us, they were first introduced to us in the Old Testament. They are discussed in detail in the chapter The Giants in Volume 1 of The Ark of Millions of Years. Approximately 200 fallen angels cast down to a lower universe were called the Watchers, or the Sons of God. Samyaza was their leader. In Roslyn Chapel, in the town of Roslyn, Scotland, his carving is carefully placed in the wall near the altar window. The builders of Roslyn Chapel, under the close protection of the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway, the 15th century Agnews of Stranraer, Scotland, built one of the holiest sites in the entire United Kingdom with a clear message, never forget, as they sealed it with their lives. They were off-worlders with intelligence and experience with trans-dimensional travel and knew the origin and destiny of mankind. Some were winged. Some had less than human features, like full body fur or exceedingly long limbs. They were not of our creation, but rather were enemies of God. They knew the daughters of men and fathered many tribes of giants. They had immense power and influence over the anthropological development of man. Many of the tribes of giants became leaders, warriors, and predators. Like all children, some followed their fathers, and some did not. These giants, part Nephilim and part human, were very strong. They could carry as much as 5,000 pounds in their bare hands. Some were as tall as 36 feet, but could not survive well on our Earth. On the higher Earth, they may have fared better than on the temporal Earth, where the first created race of man thrived. The most successful ones were around 12 feet tall. They could run as fast as a horse and cleave a human in two with one blow of a sword. They grew to great height and strength when very young, but they did not age well after the union of the polarity. Hundreds of generations later, their genes have become recessive in many races and dominant in others. Occasionally we see six toes, six fingers, multiple rows of teeth, and excessive height coalesce in human births. Giants over the height of 8 feet do not live much past the age of 30 in modern times. Even those races that seem to have a propensity of seven-footers do not produce long lifespans and display idiosyncratic genetic weaknesses that manifest themselves in a debilitating manner later in life. The Watchers existed on both Noah's Earth, also called the Higher Earth, and upon the primitive temporal Earth, also called the Lower Earth. Prior to the union of the polarity discussed in Volume 1, they worked their mission of deception and corruption. On Noah's Earth, they had corrupted the family of man so fully that the family unit was not recognizable. Rampant incest, homosexuality, and bestiality left the procreative process in a shambles. The process of procreation inside the bonds of marriage had been so completely disregarded by the general population that there was no hope of returning to the original plan of society. God sent a message to Noah that he was going to destroy the earth by flood in a reclamation effort not unlike reformatting a corrupted hard drive. As many of the giants did not follow their father's desires that they enslave or consume humanity, they consulted with the prophet Enoch. They tried for a generation to convince God they deserved to be saved when the flood arrived. Enoch went to the Lord many times on their behalf. Each time he returned with the same answer. They would not be spared the fate of the wicked. The Nephilim, however, were off-worlders. They had the ability to leave the planet. How did they survive the cataclysms? Although the Nephilim are experienced and ageless, they can be captured for eternity. They can become trapped beneath landslides, cast into space with no means of propulsion, or held in prison. Cataclysms were sent to various planets in an attempt to expunge them from those worlds and erase the corruption they had sown. Asteroids, earthquakes, floods, and even plagues were employed by God through various prophets to drive these evildoers out of existence. The giants, a hybrid offspring of Nephilim and human unions, feared the prophets. The Nephilim did not. Though they were committed to soiling the seed of man and corrupting whatever teachings or morals of the prophets, they were also committed to self-preservation. There is clear evidence that they commissioned thousands of giants and many thousands of humans to build and maintain elaborate planetary alignment measurement systems to ensure a cataclysm did not take them unawares. Using the materials available on the planet, they designed elaborate and precise planetary measuring devices to detect the slightest shift in alignment of the Earth with the stars and its neighboring planets. They knew that any change meant a cataclysm was coming. Stonehenge, meaning stone circle, in southern England, is only one of many such devices built with the strength of giants, the intelligence and precision of the Nephilim, and the sweat and blood of human slaves. These devices verified the position of certain star systems several times a year. This verification was reported to the Nephilim, who arranged their time on Earth accordingly. When the signs indicated there was a cataclysm coming, they would begin the long preparations to vacate the planet. They left the Earth prior to the flood of Noah and returned after the flood subsided to rebuild their corruption. All of these elaborate measuring devices had to be built out of existing materials. That doesn't make the design and construction any less of a marvel for modern man to behold. However, a great source of confusion for many is the reason why those structures were built. The reason is simple and has powerful ramifications. The Watchers couldn't control the cataclysms. Global floods, polar shifts, close passes by other large gravitational bodies, or sudden superstorms could not be prevented. They could only be avoided if one could receive enough warning. Precursors of the arrival of such things had to be measured so the Watchers could make arrangements to survive. The slightest change in stellar alignment would indicate the Earth was moving out of position. The slightest difference in solar timing or in the position of the rising or setting of the sun would indicate a cosmic change. These changes were associated with cataclysms. The Watchers wanted to be warned lest they be destroyed. They needed to know when to leave. Leaving the Earth too soon would allow the prophets a chance to guide the recovery of mankind. Leaving too late would mean the possible loss of life. One cannot help but speculate on exactly how the Nephilim move from planet to planet, or even if they leave the planet in times of trouble. There are a few possibilities that are common ideas. They may remove themselves from the planet to a distance from which they can observe the cataclysm. The nearest natural satellite is Earth's moon. Would they rest on the surface, eating small snacks in their titanium can, or do they have a facility where they can repose? Suppose the moon is hollow, as many people speculate. Perhaps it is only partially hollow. We do know from spectrographic data and from soil analysis, the moon's soil is close to 25% oxygen by weight, Earth's own atmosphere is around 21 to 23% by weight. If one could simply create a pressurized environment on the moon or inside the moon, it is quite feasible to supply that internal atmosphere with a suitable oxygen content directly from lunar soil. With unfiltered solar energy, some elementary chemistry principles, and the right equipment, this is completely possible. If one wanted to rest at a distance while polar shifts, volcanic upheavals, and global tsunamis cleanse the surface, this would be the perfect vantage point. We also know that the moon has the most unique orbit in the known universe relative to Earth. It revolves on its own axis, but the rate of spin is exactly the same rate at which it orbits the Earth. Hence, fully bright or totally eclipsed, the same side of the moon faces the Earth at all times. From our vantage point, we never get to see the other side of the moon. The moon's albedo, the percentage of brightness from reflected sunlight, is radically different between the side that faces Earth and the dark side of the moon. The side facing Earth is heavily marked with massive craters and covered with a dark layer of iron dust. The albedo from the Earth side of the moon is about 10%, meaning about 10% of the sun's light reflects from the moon. The albedo of the far side of the moon is over 60%. If the moon revolved any other way, we would have to wear sunglasses during the night of the full moon. With a 750-nanometer filter, one can easily see the difference between the two sides of the moon. Actually, the crust is much thicker on the far side of the moon. This fact makes the moon's orbit even more of an anomaly. The heavier side of the moon should be geotropic with respect to the Earth. The centripetal force of the moon's orbit is not nearly enough to ensure such a stable orientation. A difference of even 1 meter per year would change the Earth night forever. If the exact match of orbit and rotational speed, it has not changed since the two bodies were brought together, is not enough to wonder about, then consider that the moon is placed in orbit so precisely, it completely eclipses the sun with only the corona revealed. The point is that there is an excellent design in the placement and operation of the moon. The probability of this level of order and perfection occurring in a universe of entropy is so remote as to be immeasurable. How could the Nephilim not utilize such a perfect location for avoiding the cataclysms of Earth? The other possibility is that the Nephilim have an ability to manipulate openings into other dimensions, from which nearly the same vantage point might be gained. This is a little more difficult for humans to conceptualize. We're used to three dimensions, although science fiction filmmakers have made it easier for us to accept, considering the ability to physically slip through a portal into another dimension in the nick of time to avoid utter annihilation will earn one criticism that is not easy to outlive. Besides, other than perhaps physical preparation of one's body or psyche, why would the Nephilim require such elaborate and precise measuring devices to give them as much warning as possible? It appears that they required time, energy, and planning to leave the planet. The other possibility is that the Nephilim did not leave the planet at all. They simply passed within it. You've heard the stories. The Earth is hollow. The Earth is hollow? Well, what evidence is there that the Earth is hollow? There is the famous Admiral Byrd story where he ostensibly flew into the interior of the Earth over lush green fields, trees, and flocks of tropical birds. Unfortunately, there is no independent evidence of an opening into the core of the Earth. Yet. There is plenty of evidence produced during every significant earthquake, with hundreds of seismic phones listening and mapping the core of the planet like a giant MRI. What does it show? There is a diagram in the book. It's the classical geological way of interpreting seismic waves generated during an earthquake. They suppose, from this data, that the Earth's crust is about 800 to 1,000 miles thick. There is an interface that changes the velocity of the wave, and thus the angle of the wave. But now look at the diagram below. It shows a shadow wave. It's called the P wave. You observe the P wave strike the shadow zone in this figure. Modern geologists are at a complete loss at explaining how this wave follows this strange pathway through a solid core, counter-rotating in a liquid magma. They have made up exceptions and rules designed to support their molten core theory, rather than reach out for a more accurate explanation. Consider an alternative theory that explains the seismic vibrations in the shadow zone quite well. There is an illustration in the book. In this figure, one can see a theory proposed by Jan Lambrecht, whereby the density of the core does not increase, but rather it decreases. In fact, the outer core and the inner core described in the first illustration do not exist at all in this model. Still, the shadow zone is vibrating quite nicely without the insertion of special refraction adjustments needed to allow for these waves in the classical model. Think about it. The space shuttle orbits the Earth at an altitude of about 240 miles. If the crust was the same distance and thickness, about 6,100 miles of open space would remain in which a core could be centered within an inner atmosphere. Could the core be a small star? Could it be a solid and warm iron ball spinning like the core of a planet-sized generator? Could it be a small black hole itself? The truth is, we do not know. The seismic data collected over the past 20 years supports the Hollow Earth model better than any other mathematical theory. The fact that the Earth has a wonderfully functional magnetosphere is evidence of a dielectric between the core and the crust. The differential between their rotational speeds is precisely what generates Earth's magnetic flux. This rotational differential simply cannot be possible with a solid core floating in molten magma under pressure beneath a solid crust. Now, if there is a place for visitors to reside without being seen by surface dwellers, except when they're harassing radar operators, I suppose we need to discuss UFOs. They have been popularized by film and composition. There is scarcely a person who can be found who will deny their existence. I have not seen one. I have seen pictures, videos, drawings, and heard a thousand stories about their existence. The physicist in me knows that it is impossible for the occupants of a craft of any size to travel hundreds of years to Earth from even the nearest star system. There is no practicality, economy, or purpose in launching a craft half a millennia across open space to a civilization whose first radio broadcasts won't reach the closest stars for another 10 years. That is unless those craft have another way of moving through space that uses technology other than simple space flight. There must be a way for these craft to move across vast distances of space in a relatively short amount of time. There must be a way for activities on our Earth in our time to be known by other worlds, dimensions, or universes. We do not know if the Watchers use craft to move to and from Earth, or if they have a way of simply phasing to and from Earth. It appears, from the preparation time they commissioned human civilization to provide them, that they require a period of time to prepare for travel of this kind. The fact that they are fallen creatures apparently means that they are not capable of travel to higher dimensions. They would only be qualified to exist in dimensions less than the one from which they were cast out. Beings from lower dimensions, lower vibrational capabilities, or lower glory cannot withstand the energy of higher dimensions. Beings must be transfigured by one with authority in order to withstand even a temporary exposure to higher dimensions. So, how do the craft travel across vast distances of space and time to visit Earth so casually? The evidence points to a transdimensional method of travel. There seems to be two main possibilities that have support, albeit fringe support, from the scientific community. The evidence can also be classified paranormal. In any case, the organization of energy, time placement, and application is no casual matter. Unlike the imagined methods popularized by space science fiction writers and television programs, moving from one universe, dimension, or phase to another evidently requires huge amounts of energy, planning, and experience to accomplish. It is no easy thing to arrive, leave, and decide to return to the same place in time and space. It is believed by the authors that this has a basis in the theories that govern vibration, partial to the wave portion of the nature of matter. In the wave-particle duality of matter, there is a Heisenberg uncertainty that the observer cannot state the absolute location or state of anything without affecting the very thing he is trying to observe. String theory in a nutshell says that the mode of harmony between frequencies results in matter. That is to say, when two or more pitches of energy strings so fine as to be measured on a quantum scale in Planck units of sound harmonize perfectly, the result is something solid in a particular dimension. Keep in mind that there are at least 10 dimensions in which this can mathematically occur, not including the dimension of time. The more energy in a string, the longer it becomes. Changes in wavelength, also associated with energy, can be identified with different subatomic particles or waves. One such vibration is called a graviton. It may be the very packet of energy that coalesces other energy into harmonies that form matter. This voice of energy calls matter to collect in one place. At first, it is only dust. Then rocks, asteroids, moons, and planets form. Then, as energy and metals allow, one such mass becomes a sun. Through evolution, orbits and nebula are formed. This is how the temporal Earth was formed shortly after the Big Bang. Whether the voice of gravity is a word from a creator to organize or a random event, one must eventually choose. Humans, with their limited senses, have a hard enough time with three dimensions. Manipulating or controlling the frequencies might allow matter to move from dimension to dimension, and hence from universe to universe. There are rules to this movement, just like there are rules to mathematics. What is done on one side of the equation must also be done to the other side of the equation in order to maintain balance. The entropy information of known matter is inextricably linked with the entropy of unknown matter, shielded from the observer by some horizon. That horizon could be that of a black hole, a magnetic barrier, or behind a veil in some other dimension. In other words, if a person could excite all the molecules in their body and spirit, they might be able to travel great distances, and perhaps through time itself, returning to the exact moment, or another moment for that matter, may be a result of experience and ability on the part of the traveler. There is a harmony between one's spirit and their body as they coexist in this dimension at any given moment. The presence of one's consciousness in a set of energy being observed is affected by the consciousness of the observer. Think of it like the edge of space. Space is called space because there is some countable and measurable energy or particles in that region. Wondering what is beyond that edge, where there is currently nothing but void, may have an effect on that space. Traveling to that region of void transposes that void into space, because the ions from one's own rocket engines are countable. The movement of one's spacecraft through that void introduces energy in the form of heat, light, and even gravitational waves, which also turn the void into space. So the void is unobservable without transposing the void into space. It has been proven that the universe is expanding, and that rate of expansion increases with each passing moment. It is reasonably guessed that the universe is not rotating. Well, this brings up a problem. Without the centripetal forces of a rotating body constructed with mass, diameter, and speed of rotation, how can the rate of expansion accelerate? If this is true, and there is some dissension by the authors, then there is additional energy, and thus mass, being poured into our universe from another universe or dimension. If the universe is rotating, and there is a fixed amount of matter in the universe, then there must be areas of void being formed as matter blazes off toward outer darkness in order to balance the equation. There actually are no such voids being formed. So how does the equation balance? Where is the rest of the matter? We affectionately call this extra matter and energy that appear to be filling the void dark matter and dark energy. We're also not able to directly measure either of these quanta except through difference measurements. That is to say, one can tell the weight of 100 marbles in a weightless bucket by first weighing the bucket with the marbles, then filling all the voids in the bucket with water and reweighing the assembly. By subtracting the actual weight from the theoretical weight, as if the bucket was filled only with water, one can deduce the weight of the marbles. Weighing space is the same way, except we use a sampling of known area. The difference between theoretical and actual is huge without the balancing act described above. The Watchers left both planets prior to the flood, which culminated in the merging of Noah's Earth with the temporal Earth, also known as the Union of the Polarity. Where did they go? How did they travel? We will do our best to offer some evidence in this chapter. The giants remained behind, and along with almost total annihilation of wayward populace of mankind, 90% of them perished. After the flood, the Watchers returned. Their pattern of leadership changed significantly, as the new race of mankind, developing rapidly as a hybrid of Noah's race and the more ancient temporal race of men, was more sophisticated. Although the lifespan of the hybrid was not nearly that of Noah's race, they possessed a spirit of discernment that was not so easily mastered by the Watchers. The global dynasties of Atlantis and Mu were gone. but the core beliefs of how the Earth was created, their origin in the stars, remained. This common origin for these symbols permeates every community for the rest of time. Even today, the symbols we use for professional or governmental icons have their origin with these ancient establishments. The almost genetic belief in this eternal nature of the soul acted like an anchor to which men attached their roots, so they could not be swayed easily by every wind of doctrine. In doing so, they unwittingly aligned themselves with the very origins the Watchers had taught to their ancestors. Some of the races kept themselves pure and would not allow any marriage outside their own people. The reason behind this pathway to freedom condensed into traditions, rituals, and even religions. From this, the Watchers had no success in turning the believers. The Jews, by and large, hold to this tradition, and thus their gene pool is vastly different than the rest of human society. But more importantly than the anthropological aspects of the rebellion against the Watchers, modern man will not respond to them the same as ancient man. Offworlders were readily accepted by ancient civilizations as angels, gods, or the Shining Ones. The appearance of UFOs, aliens, or even direct contact with extraterrestrials has been satirized or portrayed with special effects so much by the media that it scarcely raises an eyebrow anymore. In fact, visual and audio technology has achieved such a high level that at the writing of this book, seeing something on film is no longer enough evidence for proof. Film technicians can even fabricate live news feeds so that the public gets one version when the reality of the situation may have been completely different. The reality of the existence of UFOs is so connected with mainstream psychosis or even classified paranormal that the general public would no more associate themselves with anything like unto worship of offworlders than they would a dashboard icon. Why are they here? All is not love, peace, and happiness in the universe. God is not loved by everyone. He has enemies. The reader must learn this one extremely important aspect of our existence in the universe. The Watchers are his enemies. They came to Earth, and in fact to all the creations of God, to corrupt or eliminate his plans, not simply to kill all humans. Murdered innocent humans are saved in heaven. This does not meet the needs of their dark master. They must either convince you to choose evil, or they will attempt to make it so difficult to make the right choice that the wrong choice becomes almost your only choice. In ancient times, they used idols, symbols, and huge engineering projects to teach mankind their idolatrous version of history. These practices were the gateway of distraction that led to the corruption of both the temporal and spiritual earths prior to the union of the polarity that occurred during the flood of Noah. The Watchers taught that the early races of man came from the stars. Although that may be partly true, they left out a very important part. The stars are not to be worshipped as gods. This strategy was known by God and was of utmost importance to him when speaking to the prophets. When he delivered 10 commandments to Moses, the first 2 commandments pertained to this very warning: Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. They designed and directed the construction of the pyramids, Stonehenge, the Mayan temples, and numerous elaborate measuring devices with which to watch and worship the stars from whence they came. Even though they were made of primitive materials, they were built to extremely tight tolerances and specifications. Those early races were also taught the art of war by the Nephilim. Killing for personal gain was an easy practice to adopt when the spiritual leaders to whom the people gave their allegiance glorified it so. The many tribes of giants whom the Nephilim spawned were also very warlike. In many records they were classified as cannibals. Their methods of warfare were so brutal, those who came against them had to master their fear in battle. This was made even more difficult for human warriors, because giants were capable of producing tremendous sound with their voices. They had special nasal cavities, multiple rows of teeth, and lungs 6 times the size of human lungs. They could scream so loud the vibrations were known to move objects. This was called harmonic levitation. They could literally blow a man down with their screams. The Nephilim also taught the early races to limit access to energy, technology, fresh water, and to hoard food resources. They taught them how to control commerce, develop classes of wealth and slavery, and also how to dehumanize their enemies with weapons of mass destruction. Ancient writings are full of their influence. Ancient carvings show their very close relationship with earthly kings. Even though they were far more advanced than most humans, they were limited in number and had to work with the materials and abilities that existed here on the earth at the time. It may have been impossible for them to teach ancient man all the skills they needed to make this earth a paradise for them. It would be much like an engineer being stranded in a third world country without electricity or a supply of sophisticated parts or tools. In a single lifetime, an entire village under his tutelage couldn't learn enough to build the first lawnmower or pocket calculator. He may know those things once existed for him, but he couldn't train enough people in all the component design and production processes to make any of those things. Have the Watchers returned again since the Flood to try to influence mankind? Yes. They will never give up the planet or the race they are commissioned to eliminate from the collective of God's creations. So why do they not step out into the open and claim the earth as their own? Why don't they show themselves and their craft to the world? Actually, we don't see evidence of them ever working directly with the masses. They always worked through the leadership behind the scenes. They were much more effective with the art of delegation through greedy kings and rulers who would gladly sell out their people for ultimate power or even a promise of peace through superior firepower. If you'll remember, the Romans had global peace on the earth for 1,000 years. They ruled with such brutality and such superior fighting skills that history records only a skirmish or two during that millennium. In their effort to conquer the entire world, Roman soldiers were sent to remote areas where they had to fight against tribes of giants. Although the most battle-hardened and organized troops in the world, they were often pounded into the afterlife by giant warriors. The Romans had to develop special war tactics to defeat them. War machines were built that could hurl a single bolt 12 feet long, weighing over 200 pounds for terrific distances. Some historians claim these machines were for breaching the walls of castles. But many of the barbarian regions were giants, were well known, conquered by Rome, did not build castles. These weapons were for killing giants. The Romans built a weapon, a bolt launcher, called a ballista. 9 feet long, it was able to throw iron bolts at very high velocity. The Holy Roman Empire also controlled the church, and through all the world's leadership as well. No one dared rise up against the vestige of power that smacked of divinity. A practice of economic shunning or refusing to trade or even speak to anyone who was judged to be a heretic could bring even kings to their knees. No amount of wealth could help them survive. The state-controlled religion wiped out the last vestiges of true holiness through mass beheadings, burnings, and hangings. Anyone caught owning scripture, memorizing or quoting scripture, or trying to copy down a few words was summarily hunted down and executed. Most of the greatest translators, all the way up to the 16th century, were murdered by the state's church leaders. William Tyndale spent his entire frail life translating the Old and New Testaments into English. His translations were not only very accurate, they were beautifully poetic and revealed the spirit of the song-like ancient Hebrew script. Rather than working from the Greek and sometimes misleading state texts, he used the ancient Hebrew texts made of solid lines of consonants with no spaces or vowels. Extreme skill and a spirit for deciphering these manuscripts was required. He constantly moved and changed his name to avoid capture by church authorities. Finally, just after completing his work, he was captured and thrown in jail. His health continued to decline. He was kept in a dungeon and only let out for 2 events. The first time was to stand trial for heresy, at which he was judged guilty for his translations. The second was to be led to a stake, where he was strangled and then burned. Fortunately, his work lives on as a major part of the King James Version of the Holy Bible. The Nephilim worked closely with ancient kings to assure them ultimate rule. In exchange, the Nephilim replaced God with idols, symbols, and their own version of creation. Nephilim exerted tremendous influence over the kings of the earth. They have always been successful at manipulation through the divulgence of new technology to one side and then deftly giving it to the other side as well. One can see in the figure above in the book the image of the winged Nephilim holding a pine cone over the back of the earthly kings. The common interpretation is that the seeds coming out of the pine cone are bits of knowledge. It is just as likely that these are not symbolic, but rather devices through which they manipulated the leaders of the world. The winged disc over the Tree of Life symbol is a crystal clear indicator of the intention of the guidance being offered by the Nephilim. The kings received knowledge of war, economics, engineering, and social sciences. In exchange, their doctrine replaced that of the Creator, according to plan. Opposing kings are given nearly equal levels of technology, so that warfare is never too one-sided. After all, it is not victory that is the goal of the Nephilim, but war itself. When the Nephilim appeared in ancient days, they were heralded as angels and gods, probably because their abilities to travel and manipulate energy was so far advanced as to be considered only possible by a deity. When they come to earth now, they are not heralded as deity. They are regarded as offworlders. But today they work as counselors behind the scenes with the various leaders of Earth. The leaders of the world have always learned much from the beings who can travel through space-time as easily as we plan a trip across an ocean. Modern people who think about such things ask, what exactly are they teaching the leaders of the world? And what do the Nephilim get out of teaching them? Indeed, spending and organizing energy to come here and bear this primitive world is an investment in something. They are either trying to educate mankind in how to live with the earth in perfect balance and understand the potential value of the race, or they are feeding the greed and lust of earthly leaders so the race can continue its cycle of self-annihilation. Recorded history seems to point to the latter purpose. A kind and benevolent, vastly more adept teacher would most certainly take control of the airplane before the student crashes into the ground. The Gulf. The population of Earth is reaching the levels once enjoyed by civilizations like Atlantis and Mu. We are beginning to explore outer space, although we have not yet discovered how to enter trans-dimensional portals. Our level of weaponry has also progressed, perhaps beyond that of ancient civilizations, and perhaps not. Ancient civilizations had global war with weapons of mass destruction. They were not mature enough after 10,000 years of development to restrain themselves from war. In the end, a series of three great cataclysms destroyed them all. Modern civilization is also quite capable now of global thermonuclear war. Will we pass the threshold of self-destruction and survive? Will we also suffer through cataclysms of volcanoes, earthquakes, and even perhaps cosmic encounters? Will we suffer the same fate as the ancients? It appears that mankind has reached this precipice before and failed to resist the urge to leap. Our ancient ancestors either were not aware of the ramifications of global warfare with energy weapons, or they were fully aware and did not care. We would like to think we are a more noble race than they. But when Oppenheimer's team tested the first plutonium bomb, they actually did not know whether or not the free hydrogen in the atmosphere would be drawn into the chain reaction and set the atmosphere on fire. They ran a risk of killing every living thing on the planet with the first test. The yield of the bomb was estimated based on the mass and atomic number of the enriched fuel. The actual explosion was so surprising that many of the team refused to continue. The nuclear leaders, including Einstein, argued that the power was too terrible as a weapon. Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer quoted ancient Sanskrit literature in an interview conducted after he watched the first atomic test. Quoting from the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." "I suppose we all felt that way," he said. He spent years trying to convince the American leadership that the benefits of nuclear research could meet the world's needs for clean energy for centuries. Of course, the value of its power as a weapon was the only reason the research was funded in the first place. 20 years later, it would be used as a means to generate cheap and clean electricity. The nuclear power plants built in the early 60s are still operating today. Economic and political pressures from all sides stopped the construction of nuclear power plants in the United States in the early 80s. There has not been a single yard of concrete poured in the United States for a new nuclear power plant since before there was such a thing as home computers. There have been more than 50,000 nuclear warheads built instead. Many thousands of these are deployed all around the globe in strategic locations, some of them mobile and undetectable, in a diplomatic balancing act, in an effort to maintain peace between superpowers, with an insane philosophy called mutually assured destruction. The very appropriate acronym is MAD. Evidence seems to support the fact that our ancient brothers could also not resist the urge to use the power of the stars as a weapon. The textbook of basic radioactive chemistry used by Tsinghua University has the following paragraph. The natural uranium in the Oklo mine in Gabon, West Africa, contains an abnormal amount of uranium-235. It is as low as 0.29%, rather than the normal 0.72%. Geologists theorize that many self-sustained nuclear fission chain reactions took place at this mine about 2 billion years ago. 13 nuclear reactors existed in prehistoric periods along the 200-meter mine bed, and they were comparable to the modern nuclear reactor in power and heat combustion. This mine had the capability of enabling self-sustained nuclear chain reactions. This discovery, that shocked the entire scientific community in 1972, has already been forgotten by people today. When excavations of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, shown above in the book, reached the street level, they discovered skeletons scattered about the cities, shown below holding hands laying in the streets, as if some instant horrible doom had taken place. People were just lying, unburied, in the streets of the city. These skeletons are 25,000 years old, even by traditional archaeological standards. Why did the bodies not decay or get eaten by wild animals? Furthermore, there is no apparent cause of a physically violent death. Even though they are 500 times older, these skeletons are among the most radioactive ever found, on par with those at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. At one site, Soviet scholars found a skeleton which had a radioactive level 50 times greater than normal. There is only one way this level of radioactivity could be found in skeletons discovered in this arrangement: thermonuclear war. There is no credibility in the theory that this catastrophe occurred naturally. It is the direct result of weapons of mass destruction. Other cities have been found in northern India that indicate nuclear explosions occurred. One such city, found between the Ganges and the mountains of Rajmahal, revealed huge masses of walls and foundations of the ancient city fused together, literally vitrified. And since there is no indication of a volcanic eruption at Mohenjo-Daro, or at the other cities, the intense heat to melt clay vessels can only be explained by an atomic blast or some other unknown weapon. The cities were wiped out entirely, purely because the evidence does not support the traditional anthropological dates of humanity. Reporters have discarded the obvious data and substituted it with their own convoluted theories. While the skeletons have been carbon dated to 2500 BC, we must keep in mind that carbon dating involves measuring the carbon daughters of carbon-14, left to decay at a known half-life cycle. Additional radiation, either cosmic or nuclear, may alter the decay by adding electrons and neutrons onto the structure and even shifting the mean subatomic weight. Fortunately, in modern times, a weapon like this has only been used twice. The theories that such a fission reaction could occur naturally are, in our opinion, at best, far-fetched. Given the mass of uranium on the planet, radon daughters of uranium emanate through the soil of almost every square foot of dry land. The odds of another reaction similar to this theory would be very good. Since there have been no recorded events like this, or irradiated fields where this has occurred, there is no other evidence to support such a theory. The ancient records support the theory that thermonuclear weapons were used by ancient warriors against each other, having the same devastating effects as those observed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The actual radioactive plume from Nagasaki rose 11 kilometers into the sky. Many records indicate that the Nephilim managed to use their technology to enable them to live somewhere else on the planet, or even temporarily leave the planet when these events occur. Ancient records seem to indicate that when cataclysms of cosmic proportions occur, the Nephilim exist before and after the event. In some ancient records, it seems the cataclysm was precipitated by God to wipe out the Nephilim, who had so corrupted his plans. UFOs may be the very craft that they and their genetic creations used to move themselves and their cargo about the planet. The Nephilim are masters of planetary domination. One might ask how a team of off-worlders, even with their skills and aptitude, could bring an entire planet into control without a blatant display of superior weaponry. It appears that when they come here, they have only the clothes on their back and what knowledge they possess. So how would they do it? They might pit one nation against another, providing only enough technology to maintain the balance of power. Both sides would spend vast portions of their budget to gain a military advantage.